Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Gondert. Today, market historian Bob Hoy from chartsandmarkets.com fills in for Ross Clark to take a look at the major markets. He tells us the Dow has had a tremendous surge upwards, the likes of which we have not seen since 2017. Bob also takes a look at gold, crude, junk bonds, and copper. Bob also joins the show to take a look at headlines that caught his eye this week, including the U.S. government draining its strategic oil reserve for political reasons. He also answers listener questions. Publisher of WolfStreet.com, Wolf Richter, joins us from San Francisco. Does he think the U.S. dollar is about to lose its reserve currency status? Is America about to slip into recession, or will red-hot consumer spending prevent an economic slowdown? And can electric vehicles ever compete with ICE autos price-wise? We'll talk to Bob Hoy right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He's speaking to us from Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Bob.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good to be with you, Jim, and with our audience out there.
Ross Clark is on assignment today, so Bob will be filling in, taking a look at the major markets. Anything big happened this week on Wall Street?
Oh, yeah. They've had a real rush. Yesterday's headline was that the Dow Jones, the old venerable Dow Jones average, had made 9 consecutive trading days up.
Bob, what made the Dow so exciting?
Well, it's been on a run. Everything's been happy, 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 and we had 10 trading days in a row up for the Dow averages. Hasn't done that since 2017.
Wow, that is almost semi-historic.
No, it's fun.
What about the other indices?
Well, they're up as well. The stock market is in a very strong phase. As a matter of fact, it's beginning to get a little overdone. The bond market, long-dated treasuries or Canada's have been kind of quiet. But with the street wishing to put on all kinds of risk, junk bonds have been acting well. So, and there's not much movement in copper. It's been a couple of good weeks for crude oil, and but nothing sensational for commodities overall.
Mm-hmm. Anything happening with gold?
Yeah, it's been sort of steady. We don't see much change in gold ahead of us, and because the U.S. dollar has become rather steady.
Bob, a great market wrap-up here. Now, let's go to what we usually do on the weekend. We take listener questions, and our question comes from Kathleen. I haven't seen it yet, but you know Kathleen loves to refer to classical music, movie themes, and so on. And so as I'm opening the email, hi, Bob and Jim. Zero Hedge headline, Rand Paul warns, we're out of ammo, we're out of money. Ginger Rogers opened up the film Gold Diggers of 1933 singing, we're in the money, we're in the money, we've got a lot of what it takes to get along. Well, 90 years later, the West doesn't look like it has a lot of what it takes to stimulate the economy and doesn't seem to get along with the BRIC nations. The West apparently has neither ample guns for foreign wars nor butter to avoid recession. And these are all quotes from the movie. It's terrific. Bob, is the West at an impasse?
No, it's been in a hellhole for almost 100 years. And it's becoming so bad that I think there's a great reformation coming up. So, and this would be prompted by the next recession, where both governments and people seriously run out of money. And then the folks are going to take a look and say, look, all you guys do is declare war on other countries and declare war on us, the taxpayers. And when the taxpayers get, the tax amounts get painful, then you go in and you inflate, you depreciate the currency. So it's been quite a political struggle. And I think it's sort of maxing out now. And, but it's interesting that in the final stages of a post-bubble contraction, the real price of gold goes down. So the gold stocks underperform in the final part of the bubble. And then eventually real price of gold goes up, and it has been doing that. But the gold stocks have had some good rallies, but are being, they had a good rally and due for a correction. But now we're looking for perhaps some heaviness in the stock markets after August, and this would bring down the gold stocks. So we'll be watching for the gold stocks to for next buying opportunity in the sector, because on future rallies, it's quite likely that the gold stocks, like the GDXJ, would outperform the Standard & Poor's, the S&P. And you get a few quarters of that going, you're aggressive fund manager out there is going to say, hey, it's a good sector, I got to get in. So the long distance for the gold stocks is looking good.
Kathleen has a second question. Is there a possibility that President Biden and EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have a grand plan that soon will be disclosed?
Oh, yeah, their plan is to mess up the Western world as best they can, and they've been doing a very good job of it because they are control freaks. And what you want to do in order to gain control is you have to destroy what exists, which is the economy and the middle class part of society. So, no, they're evil authoritarians. So, well, also, I'll put in a definition that I like to use in the transition from authoritarian, which is what we're getting in the States and in Canada, and the transition to totalitarian is when the governing classes grant themselves the privilege of state murder. And that's when their ideas are becoming so bad, the only way they can impose them is with the threat of execution. And that's not going to happen because folks in Canada and the U.S. are beginning to figure it out and realize that you got to have a reform. So thanks for the question.
And Bob, my question is, since the Federal Reserve was invented back in the early 1900s, it was supposed to stop all future recessions and depressions. How successful has it been?
Yeah, prior to... Yeah, the wheelers and dealers who started the Federal Reserve System, they knew that a financial crisis would precipitate a recession. So they invented this idea that with the Federal Reserve as lender of last resort, there would be no credit disasters and therefore no recessions. And it still is a very appealing idea. But since the Fed opened its doors for business in January 1914, there's been 18 cyclical recessions. Now, in any other discipline of inquiry, all you need is one failure to bring down the theory. This thing is now out to 18 failures. And so, no, the Fed will not be able to stem a contraction when it gets really underway. Now, I'm very confident that there will be a contraction because the yield curve inverted, and the yield curve is the difference between short rates and long rates. And when short rates get higher than long rates, that's inverted, and every time the U.S. yield curve inverts, it's followed by a recession without fail. So, shall we say it's in the cards. So this might become visible maybe after August. Things are slowing down a little now. The global economy has had to accommodate the huge whack of the COVID lockdown. And then since then, the positive side has been ordinary folk wanting to get back to work and normal life. And now, but you still have the inverted yield curve facing us. And so I think maybe after August, there'll be a strengthening of the dollar and a weakening of many commodities, and the credit markets are starting to have a problem.
Headline I saw, as we get into headlines that caught your eye, a headline I saw from the China Times: Chinese parents are now so poor that they can no longer afford to buy liquid milk for their children, and they're switching to powdered milk because it's much more affordable. Is that a good indication of what's happening to the Chinese economy?
Well, it's showing that somewhere they're running out of money.
Now, headlines that caught Bob's eye this week from Reuters. U.S. EV market struggles with price cuts and rising inventories.
Yeah, electric vehicles. It's been a fascinating fad whereby, because you're not putting out any CO2 out of a tailpipe, it's considered pure. But the amount of mess to the environment that is done on making the electronics and the batteries for these vehicles is extraordinary. And then you have the disposal after their short lifetime is over. And in the meantime, they're damned expensive. You know, you're talking $5,000-$6,000 to replace a battery in a modest setup. And then you also have the problem that those exotic batteries with lithium in them, they can blow up all on their own. You don't have to do anything at all. They just blow up.
Yes, spectacular fires. It can take 3 days to put out an electric car fire.
Yep.
Headline, U.S. producer price inflation falls to its lowest in 3 years.
Yep. Now, a year ago in the summer, everybody was on inflation, and you had shortages, you had problems in Ukraine, we're going to dry up the grain market, all this sort of stuff. But it was all in the market as it was happening. And in June last year, we published a piece called The Bear Market in Commodities Will Eventually Get Everything, Including Energy Prices. And commodities are very much lower generally than they were last summer. So this is also signaling a slowdown in the global economy.
My question, Bob, the official inflation numbers out of Ottawa, 2.8% for June. From the U.S., it's either 3.2 or 3.4%, depending on the source. Does that mean central banks are going to stop hiking rates? Because they've almost got it down to their target of 2.
The central banks will stop hiking rates once they've seen that treasury bill rates are declining for 2 or 3 months, and then they'll realize that they got to get in line with the market and what treasury bills are doing. So the Fed follows the changes in market rates of interest.
Headline, the everything rally is back, and so is the casino crowd. That's according to Bloomberg.
Yeah, I think you can say it's a sort of an everything rally. Junk has been doing well, and more in the last few weeks, crude oil has been doing well. So, yeah, it's also, things are becoming highly speculative in a technical sense.
From AFP, record heat waves sweep the world from U.S. to Japan and Europe.
Yeah, last year there was a site that I look at, and they report all kinds of extreme weather events. And you were getting record cold stuff in the northern hemisphere, in the northern hemisphere winter. At the same time, you're getting record lows for the summer months in the southern hemisphere. But that's not reported. What is reported is some hot stuff. And for, I guess, 3 months now, the El Nino has been on. And that sends a pulse of warm air around the world. And you've had some, I call them hot domes, get set up, blocked by the jet stream, and they just get parked, and the heat builds and builds, whereas there's some places where they're getting the opposite. Well, the east coast of the States got an awful lot of cold rain a week or so ago. So it's weather and the high temperatures being recorded in the areas where they got a heat dome sitting is not an indication of climate change or too much CO2 or anything. It's just the way this year was working out.
Now, One of our listeners suggested to me the eastern seaboard of the U.S. seems to have an excess of water. The West Coast has not enough. Why don't they capture that water and pipe it? We have oil pipelines, natural gas pipelines all over North America, thousands of miles worth. Why not pipe that excess water to the West where it's needed? Why not?
No, there's a huge Oglala aquifer down under below the Great Plains, and they're using that water to bring it to the surface. And when you start messing around trying to move water from the Great Lakes, say, no, not going to happen.
Headline from Reuters, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, prepare for losses on office loans.
Oh, yeah. Empty office spaces. They're talking about converting office towers to residential. And I would think that'd be a very expensive exercise. And how many people are going to stay there? I mean, the way the Democrats have been destroying every downtown they can, like in San Francisco. Why own anything in downtown San Francisco? Because the Democrats are going to continue to screw it up.
It's not a felony to steal anything in San Francisco until you hit $1,000. I've heard gangs walk into a store with a calculator, and they go, oh, that's 750, that's 890, that's 990. Good, mm-hmm. Let's leave.
Yeah.
And the cops don't show up. It's sick.
Yeah, it's very sick, yeah.
Headline from Yahoo, massive U.S. oil caverns sit empty and will take years to fill. So they've used up their reserve, I would think.
Well, yeah, that was a strategic reserve in some huge old oil domes, and it is there for the real emergency, like it's never going to be tapped. But what happened is the Biden administration came in and shut down oil and gas production wherever they could in the states, and what happens? Oil and gas prices go up, and I'm talking about gasoline prices, and they go up. So then they get pressure from the polls. So then they pull a little of the oil out of the strategic storage thing. And it's just insanity. So the easiest way to solve the problem is to let the oil people go back to work and continue to prove up reserves and get the production back on stream. And that'll put a lid on prices and probably even bring them down.
Bob, if you ask the average person in Vancouver if air pollution today is worse than it was in the 80s, most of them will tell you yes. But I remember the 80s when it was so smoggy, in some cases, I couldn't even see across the street.
Yeah, 80s, and that was particularly so in the Los Angeles basin.
Yeah.
And it had a lot to do with emissions from car exhaust at the time, but they've cleaned that up hugely ever since then. So, yeah, you can get stagnant air anywhere, and it can get a little thick. But as you and I both know, the real reason why people live in big cities like Toronto, they like to see the air they breathe.
Yeah, well, Toronto, sometimes the air there is so thick you could breathe it with a fork.
Yeah.
Headline from Yahoo, China's murky debt corner faces funding squeeze.
Oh, yeah. This is classic post-bubble stuff. People take on debt because it's easy to take on debt, and your assets are going up in price, no problems. And then assets start going down in price, and then you got a problem. And there it is. Classic stuff.
Headline from Reuters, Evergrande's overdue results to show steep losses.
Now that one, Evergrande has been in the headlines, I think, maybe a year and a half now, Jim. And it's some huge developer in China. And I hadn't seen anything about Evergrande for a few months. So I thought, oh, here's our old friend Evergrande, still in trouble. We'll grab the headline.
Headline from Yahoo, $10 trillion stock market rally faces crucial test in earnings.
Yeah, I read that as that the advance, I guess, in the big stock market has amounted to $10 trillion increase, which is huge numbers, absolutely immense numbers. And so it's going to take something to support this, like Do we want to talk about earnings? Do we want to talk about dividends? It's pure speculation that drives this up. And there's also other headlines I didn't put in, but there's been massive short squeezes going on. And I'm telling you, some of these indexes and individual stocks really have been going straight up. And that's two things. Late buyers coming in and wanting to buy an item that's going straight up. And the other part of that is guys who shorted too early and are having to cover. And there's that, that's the other bid, and it's classic, and it goes until it ends. And then, when they go straight up, they often end in a disaster.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Yeah, Jim, good to be with you, and look forward to next week.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy, the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. If you have any questions for Bob, you can send them to info@howstreet.com, and we'll ask that question for you. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Wolf, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, could the U.S. dollar lose its status as the dominant global reserve currency?
Yeah, and you know, this is a long process, and it's sort of moving in slow steps up and down. Back in 2000, the dollar had 70% or 72% of the foreign exchange assets with other central banks. So that's how we determine whether something is the status of a global reserve currency. Now it's down to 59%. So that means that other central banks, other than the Federal Reserve, hold U.S. dollar assets, and that their combined holdings of U.S. dollar assets of treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities, corporate bonds, those kind of things, denominated in U.S. dollars. And so their combined holdings of these dollar-denominated assets are now down to 59% of the total foreign exchange assets. And so the others are the euro primarily, so that has a share of 20% globally as a reserve currency, meaning that euro-denominated assets account for about 20% of the foreign exchange reserves among central banks. And then the next one down is the yen and the British pound, and they're in the 5% range each. And then you go down further, you know, you have the RMB, the Chinese RMB, which is at roughly 2%. And so in essence, you know, the problem is right now that the second largest economy and the largest trading economy in the world, so that's China, has a very insignificant share of the global reserve currencies. And then there's a reason for that, in that the Chinese currency is not freely convertible, and there's some other issues. And so central banks are staying away from RMB denominated assets, and so it's just not moving forward. In the last four quarters, their share dropped actually a little bit. That will be a threat to the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. The other major threat is the euro. The euro is 20%. It's been flat at around 20% for 10 years. And, you know, then we have lots of smaller currencies that are coming up. And so you'll see that, you know, the dollar is losing share, not against one big currency, but it's losing share against, in little drips and drabs against other currencies. So the yen has come up, and the Canadian dollar, you know, and the Australian dollar, and all these are currencies that are getting a little bit more share as the world sort of diversifies away from the dollar. But it's still at 59%, you know, so this is still the dominant, by far the dominant currency. If it drops below, and, you know, it's been 20 years to go from 72% to 59%. You know, that's how slow the process has been. And, you know, so it'll be another 10 or 15 years, it might drop to 50%. And then when it drops below 50%, it'll be below, it won't have a majority anymore. It'd still be the largest reserve currency, but then the euro might be 25% and the yen might be, you know, 8%, and the Chinese RMB might be 5% or something. And they will all gain a little bit at the expense of the dollar. And so this is a very slow process. Nobody wants the dollar to get hurt badly. You know, there's just too much depends on it. And, it's financially, you know, these dollar assets are everywhere. Lots of companies are borrowing, and lots of governments or non-U.S. governments and non-U.S. companies are borrowing in U.S. dollars. And, it's a sort of a very stable decline that we're looking at here. And, back through the late 1970s until inflation took off in the United States, the dollar had 85% share, as a global reserve currency. That was super dominant back then. Now there's alternatives, big alternatives, like the euro. And so it's given up a lot of share to the euro when the euro came along, and then of course the yen and the British pound and those are the other major ones. And it's not really given up any over time to those currencies, but just minor amounts, you know. But the one that surged is the euro, came out of nowhere, and the one that was expected to surge was the Chinese RMB, and it hasn't yet. You know, that's not moving, and so the dollar is just sort of very slowly coming down.
What could this mean for the U.S.?
Well, right now, the fact that the U.S. has the dominant global reserve currency, meaning that other central banks are loading up on U.S. dollar assets, such as treasury securities and corporate bonds and mortgage-backed securities and agency securities and all those, that means that the U.S. government and also some other U.S. government-related entities and corporate entities are having an easy time, a relatively easy time, borrowing money by selling bonds. And there's a lot of global demand for this because it's being held as foreign exchange reserves. And so especially the government's budget deficits are fairly easy to finance because the dollar is the dominant global reserve currency. If that goes away, it's going to be more difficult for the government to finance these ridiculous deficits that we have, and they've just been getting worse and worse, and nobody really cares anymore, it seems, and because so far we've gotten away with it. And when the dollar loses its status as global reserve currency, especially the dominant one, I think it's going to be much harder for the United States to fund this government deficit. And then in addition to that, remember, we have two huge twin deficits. Yeah, we also have a huge trade deficit. So these are dollars that are going overseas and for imports, and we're exporting a lot less than we're importing. So that too has to be financed, and with the dollar being a reserve currency of that type, you know, it makes it easier to finance those trade deficits. And those twin deficits are going to become much harder to finance when we're just like the euro, you know, when we're down to 25% and the euro is 25% and the Chinese RMB is 25%, we've got that kind of situation. That will be very difficult for the United States to fund those twin deficits. But that's many years out, and this is not happening right now. This is happening very slowly, and I track this quarter by quarter based on the IMF COFA data, as he calls that, and you know, it's just, it's like watching paint dry. It's not happening quickly, and but it there is that established trend, so it's happening, and we're looking probably at many years. You know, you're talking in decades, really, rather than in quarters or months.
What are the chances of a mild or severe recession in the U.S.?
Well, it's 100%. We are going to get a recession for sure. I mean, we always get a recession sooner or later. The question is when, and that, you know, we're supposed to get a recession in late 2022 and then in early 2023, and then that was moved out to the second half of 2023, and it's just not happening. You know, the consumers are strong, the labor market is strong, consumers are spending, you know, I mean, they're supposed to stop, they're supposed to cut back on spending on goods as they're spending more on services, and they've slowed down a little bit of spending on goods, but car sales are way up. You know, there's this huge pent-up demand for cars because of the shortages we had in a couple of years ago, and so consumers are buying cars, they're out buying other stuff, their e-commerce is booming, you know, people are buying stuff, and services are you know, discretionary services such as travel right now, it's hot. I mean, travel is just hot right now, leisure travel, and it's record levels. National park attendance is record levels. You know, everything has changed, but people are spending money on experiences. They're going to concerts. They're doing all kinds of stuff, you know. And so that helps the economy. And we have, you know, some issues. Commercial real estate is in real bad shape, but, you know, it's construction. It's investment in commercial real estate that enters into our GDP calculations, not the prices commercial real estate and not the rents of commercial real estate. And so construction is still going on. We have a construction boom in multifamily of historic nature. You know, we've got a construction boom in for manufacturing plants of historic nature. And we've got all these things going on. And you know, imports have come down, imports of goods. And that's a good thing for GDP because imports are negative, that get subtracted out of GDP, you know, so that's helpful. So, you know, we see an economy that's just kind of muddling along and among different factors, it's doing just fine with our 5% plus interest rates. There are some parts that have trouble, but, you know, the things that were supposed to happen didn't happen. The consumer didn't cut back and business investment didn't cut back. You know, governments, they're spending like drunken sailors. You know, the federal government has this huge budget deficit. They're spending money left and right by the hundreds of billions of dollars a month. And you essentially cannot have a recession when you have this kind of level of spending at all levels, the government, consumers, businesses. And that's what we're looking at right now. It's just not happening. I don't think there is going to be a recession this year. Next year, I mean, that's a pretty good distance away. Anything could happen. So far, you know, it doesn't look like it. I mean, it could. I know one thing for sure. We're going to get a recession. There's always a recession. It will come sooner or later. But right now, the 5% interest rates are just not leading to it. You know, the economy has adjusted. Consumers have adjusted. Businesses have adjusted. Consumers are making more money when they have savings or money market funds or treasury bills. I mean, there is tens of billions of dollars in assets that are now earning 5% that earned near 0% before. And so that some of that money is getting spent. So, you know, it looks pretty good. You know, this economy is not booming, you know, but it's growing, and it's growing at a slower rate than it did during the recovery phase after the pandemic, but it's growing and it's stabilized in the 1-2% growth range. First quarter was stronger than that, and second quarter might be pretty good too, and maybe in the second half we'll get a little bit less growth, I don't know. You know, so I have moved my recession forecast out of this year. You know, I don't see it anymore for this year. We've been waiting for it for a year. I mean, they've been announcing it forever. It's been the most anticipated recession ever, and it's just not happening. And so I kind of gave up waiting for it. I'm just going to keep watching the signs, but I'm not seeing any major recession signs yet.
As interest rates work their way through the economy, could real estate be a concern in the second half of the year?
Yeah, real estate in terms of sales and prices is already a concern. Real estate doesn't really make a lot of sense at these prices and these rates. So we have seen commercial real estate, especially office buildings, hotels, and retail, some malls, shopping malls, get into real trouble. Of course, shopping malls have been in trouble for many years. Hotels got in trouble during the pandemic and haven't really recovered. They're facing new competition from vacation rentals that are now all over the place. And so in terms of the loans that they have taken out, they're now walking away. So the landlords are walking away from the buildings, from the loans. They're letting the lenders have the buildings and the shopping malls. That's been happening for, and shopping malls been happening for years. It's now happening with office buildings and apartment buildings. So that part is already happening. These high interest rates make no sense in commercial real estate now with the price levels where they are and with the borrowing that the leverage that they have. And so that needs to be, that needs to adjust to the new reality. In terms of housing, home sales have plunged. So they started plunging last year, last spring, and they've come way down. And there's a little bit of an uptick during the spring selling season. Now we got the June numbers and they fell again. These high interest rates make it very difficult to sell these existing homes. These are used homes. Prices have come down a little bit. In some areas, a lot more, like in San Francisco, they're down 15-16% year over year. In other places, they're down a lot less. And in some lots of cities, they're up actually year over year. So we've got this mix. And in terms of new houses, an interesting thing happened that home builders have cut the prices and they're building at lower price points and their costs have gone down and they're incentivizing. So, they've been able to boost their sales that way with these methods. So when you look at the price chart, though, you see a big drop in prices of new houses, and that's how they're competing. And now they're roughly in parallel with existing homes. So existing homes are overpriced in relationship to new houses, and so there's a lot of business going from what would be buyers in the existing home market to new homes. And that's been playing out. So I think the existing home market will adjust to that. Home prices are very high. It's not a bad thing when they come down. It is a good thing for the economy to see lower home prices, and they should come down. They need to come down. They're ridiculously high, and we've had huge price boosts since the money printing of the pandemic. It's been just ridiculous. In some markets, prices went up by 50%, which in two years, which is just insane, and that needs to come down for it to make sense. And we may see that start in the second half. So we've had the strongest time of the year now behind us through June. That's that encapsulates the spring selling season. So we're now through with that. A tendency is for the second half to be slower, to have lower prices. And so we should see some of that play out.
Can you update us on the new vehicle market in the U.S.?
Yeah, so sales are very strong. Yeah, they're up 17% in the second quarter from a year ago. Of course, they were weak a year ago because of the shortages. And so because the shortages lasted for so long, we now have what I consider to be 6 million new vehicles pent-up demand. So vehicles that weren't built and weren't sold during the time period of the shortages compared to the pre-pandemic year. So these are customers that haven't bought a vehicle that are waiting to buy a vehicle, and they're going to buy a vehicle over the next few years, in addition to the customers that would buy one anyway. So this 6 million vehicle shortage that we've had accumulated, that's now gradually phasing into the market in terms of demand. And we're seeing that. We've had lots of demands. EV sales are Tesla just reported its second quarter global sales, and we don't know US sales, but global sales are up in terms of units, 83%, so that's deliveries. EV sales are very strong. They're up 50% in the United States. Other categories of ICE vehicles, so internal combustion engine vehicles, are recovering. And so in the new vehicle market, we're still below, quite a bit below the levels of 2019 in terms of sales. But that's the highest level since then. So the market is pretty strong right now. Sales are going up. So that's another reason why the economy is plugging along, because consumers are buying cars. And prices of new vehicles, they spiked over the last couple of years. They stopped spiking. They sort of are flatlining now the last few months, maybe dipping a little bit. Now you no longer see the addendum stickers. They're gone, essentially. Now the big incentives on trucks and on other vehicles that dealers have a lot of. Of course, the fuel-efficient vehicles and Toyotas are so short supply, but other brands, are overstocked. And so that's where the deals are. And there's a little bit of an inventory mismatch in what consumers want to buy and what is on the lots now. And so you have that problem. But there, you see incentives. So this is really, if you want to buy a truck, this is a good time to buy. And, Tesla has started cutting its prices last year, and it's going through these serial price cuts and causing its sales to boom, and it put on new production capacity by building new plants and expanding capacity at the existing plant. So it's got this growth in production that it's just out for blood, and it's flooding the market with cars. And these price cuts put downward pressure prices on ICE vehicles now, because now you can buy Tesla for less than a competing vehicle with an internal combustion engine. And Ford has cut its prices on its Lightning trucks. We see other EV makers cut their prices. So this is stimulating demand. This is a big factor now in the new vehicle market. This is where the biggest demand growth is. It's in EVs, and they're starting to accumulate numbers where they actually matter. And that's going to force automakers to be careful raising the prices on the ICE vehicles, because they've got this competition of now equal or lower priced EVs that they have to deal with. And EVs are, they cost less to operate. So if the purchase cost is the same, you come out ahead with an EV. And the purchase cost is lower, you come out way ahead, and people are discovering that. So, there's a massive change in the market now, and consumers are out there buying, and they're buying, they're buying where the incentives are when they're big enough, and they're buying the stuff that they have to order and can't get. There's a lot of that too. There's still shortages in the market, the vehicle market is set for growth. Of course, it was at ridiculously low levels during the shortages. Now we're coming up from very low levels, so that's where the growth is coming from. It's from those low levels. It's not from the plateau levels we had before the pandemic, but it's coming off the low levels during the pandemic, during the shortages. And so I think we'll eventually get back to the plateau levels of pre-pandemic times.
Are used vehicles still selling for crazy prices?
Yeah, they are, and then prices have come down. Come down quite a bit last year and earlier this year, and now the last couple of months, last 4 months, they have come up, and that's quite a bit of bounce in April and May and then in June, maybe not so much. Asking prices have been kind of flat at very high levels. They're still very far above where they used to be in 2019. I don't think they're going back down there. I think this is permanent. They're going down a little bit, but they're not giving up this ridiculous price spike. They were up 45% at one point, from 2019 levels. And that's just not sustainable, but they're not going back down to 2019 levels. So they've given up some of that, but not a lot. And now they, you know, asking prices have stabilized at very high levels. And retail prices, after dropping a bunch, they've perked back up and now higher again, but still below the peak in like December 2021. And wholesale prices, they have gyrated all over the place, and it's the most destabilized pricing environment I have seen in used vehicles after those price spikes we had in 2021. It's just crazy. People don't even know really what to bid for in the wholesale market, and it's there is demand, but the prices are too high. And so the dealers are buying less in the wholesale market and the prices come down, and then they jump all over it again and prices go back up. And it's just a very destabilized pricing environment in used vehicles. And I think it will take a while for this to settle down toward some calm range, and there is still a shortage. Really not a shortage, but a supply constraint in the used vehicle market, because rental cars couldn't stock up their fleets in 2021 and 2022 as they wanted to, and the rental cars buy around 3 million units a year, and they couldn't get those units. They got some, but didn't get all of them for a couple of years. And so those units that the rental fleets are buying, they become used vehicles through the auctions and directly sold by the rental car companies through their used vehicle outlets. And, so that's an influx into the used vehicle market that hasn't taken place. These units that the rental car companies were supposed to buy and didn't buy are missing in the used vehicle market now. So they will be coming in now. That'd be 2023, 2024. The purchases in 2021, 2022 would come in, and they're not in these numbers that we need. So we have a situation where we're in fairly tight supply in the used vehicle market, and sales volume is down a little bit. The prices are still very, very high, and it hurts to see these used vehicle prices up that way. They'll drop a little bit, but I just don't think they'll go back down to where they were.
Are the established auto manufacturers struggling to attain the success that Tesla has in the electric vehicle market?
Yeah, so there's about 10-year difference. Tesla had all those issues that they're having now. Tesla had them, years ago. And Tesla was able to get its supply chain and production kinks worked out. And while it really was the only game in town. And so now it's got that worked out. It's got its supply chains worked out. It's building factories everywhere. It's boosting the capacity at its plants that it already has. A couple of years ago, its factory in Shanghai came online. It boosted production there. This year, early this year, its plant in Texas came online. Its plant in Germany came online. It's making deals in Mexico to build a plant there. It's trying to double the capacity at its plant in Germany. Yeah, so now it's doing all these things that other automakers can't do because they don't have the ducks in a row. Their award, Tesla, used to be in 2017 and 2018. They're struggling with the basics. They can't get production up. They have problems with supply chains. They have problems with some of their products. They're in the early stages. They've got people in the wrong places. They have to hire a whole new crew of employees to design and develop all the technologies that go into EVs. And at the same time, they have to, deal with the ICE vehicles. And they're kind of split between them. And then there's cannibalization going on too. When Ford sells an EV, maybe that's a customer that would have bought an ICE vehicle. So you've got that. And so they're really struggling, and they're just not producing in high volume. And, they're at quantities, that all combined, don't match to Tesla's output. So in the United States, in the U.S. market, in China, it's a different thing. China is ahead of the United States in its EV market. There are a lot more competitors, and they are putting out mass-produced vehicles with all kinds of brands. But in the United States, it's just not the case. And so, you know, it's been painful to watch how slow these legacy automakers are in ramping up and developing even EVs and ramping up EV production. I mean, Ford has a couple of models out, that it's sort of mass producing, and production is going to be ramped up, later this year on its Lightning truck. GM has a kind of a small volume built vehicle out, the Hummer. It's killing the Bolt that it has. And yeah, everything else is in the announcement stage. And, Toyota doesn't even have announcements, you know, it hardly has anything. And Honda same, you know, and so they have been so painfully slow in doing this, and it will take many, many years for them, to build their supply chains and to build the production capacity and to develop these vehicles and technologies. And, you know, I was hoping I would see a lot more competition on Tesla by now, but it's they've given Tesla so many years a head start, that it's really hard for them now to catch up. And now Tesla has these huge profit margins, you know, and it's using them. It's cutting prices because it can't afford to. It has the biggest profit margins in, among the major automakers, you know, and it's going through with these price cuts that are just killing the rest of them. And, I mean, it's out for blood it's frustrating to watch the legacy automakers struggle with that. And, of course, in a way, I love it because I have despised the auto oligopoly, as I call it, you know, for years. I mean, they have had oligopolistic pricing for two decades on the pickup trucks. They make huge, gigantic profit margins on these trucks. I mean, there's no reason why a basic pickup truck should cost $50,000 and a nicer unit should cost $100,000 US dollars. You know, the automakers have huge profit margins in these, and the only reason they were able to get those profit margins is because they stopped competing on price with each other, and that's the definition of an oligopoly. You have a few makers that make these full-size pickup trucks, and they're not competing on price. There's this kind of tacit deal between them that they're not doing that, and they're jacking up price every year. And so now you got these ridiculous price levels of these pickup trucks and these ridiculous profit margins on those trucks by the automakers. And Tesla butted in on them, and I think that's great, and I love to see that. I worked in the car business, and I was so frustrated with that, and now I'm really glad I see this, the shakeup of the legacy automakers, and, I hope they know how to respond, and I hope they know how to get the ducks in a row quick enough, to where, they can deal with this, and, you know, but they dropped the ball years ago, and so the shakeup that's now going on, I mean, it's really good to see, but it's also frustrating to see that they waited so long to respond to Tesla in any significant way.
It's not always true that electric vehicles are all expensive. In China, they're making an electric car called the Viking that sells for $10,000 US. Could we see something like that in North America?
Yeah, I mean, I've said this for the last 2 years. You know, eventually when there's lots of competition, EVs will be cheaper. They're cheaper to make. And in mass production, they're a lot simpler to assemble. The battery is the only expensive part on it. The battery prices have come down. Mass produced with lots of competitions, EVs should be cheaper than ICE vehicles at the retail level. And, the $10,000 vehicle you're looking at in China, that's a very basic vehicle. And I'm not sure American consumers will buy it, but American consumers really like fancy cars. I mean, that's us, you know, and we like fancy big equipment, and, we're generally willing to pay for it. We like all the good stuff in them. And, they need to be big and roomy and quiet, and they need to perform well. So I don't know that a $10,000 EV will take off in the United States. But I'd love to see it as an option. I mean, it would be great. Back in the day when I ran a dealership, you know, we had cheap cars. We had a $5,000 so there's a Ford, you know, a Festiva, it was called back then. It was a Korean car that Ford imported. And, it was hard to sell. if the Americans didn't want to buy it. You know, it's a good little car, got 50 miles a gallon, hatchback, you know, and very reliable little car. And you know, people with $5,000 to spend, they go over to the used car lot and buy a three-year-old big American car. And so that attitude really hasn't changed. You know, it's been tried many times before. It's really tough to sell basic cars in the United States because we just love big, fancy equipment. And so, you know, there's that issue. But, you know, the average vehicle should come down in price from where the internal combustion vehicles are now because they're just cheaper to make. So you should be able to get a decent vehicle that has all the things you want, you know, for less than what you're paying now.
Have you bought yourself an EV?
No, we have a hybrid. We bought that, thankfully, in February 2020, you know, just before gasoline prices started spiking. We used to have a sports sedan, rear-wheel drive sports sedan, you know, way too powerful. My wife drives it to work every day. You know, she just needs a commuter car. And that car got 25 miles per gallon. On a good day on the highway, and a lot worse in stop and go traffic here. And so we bought a hybrid, and it cut our gasoline consumption in half. And then the gas prices doubled, and so we kind of at the same place. But it was a good move. You know, I don't want to buy a new vehicle for her to go to work in. I mean, our car now looks like a street fighter, you know, scratched and dented and stuff, you know, because she just kind of gets in touch occasionally with something. And so I'm waiting for good used EVs to be available in large quantities that are 2 or 3 years old. And right now, you don't have a choice. You know, it's mainly Teslas that are 2 or 3 years old. You can buy used Bolt maybe, but we don't want that. So we're going to wait until there are bigger choices available for used vehicles, and then probably we're going to buy an EV.
Wolf, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, my website, wolfstreet.com, and it's free. There is no paywall. You know, everything you can, you don't have to sign up for anything. Everything is available for free. It's about business, finance, and money. And we don't talk about politics. Wolfstreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Bob Hoy and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.